Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, we're going to talk about the new USDA dietary guidelines, the effect of estrogen on weight, and more. So stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey gang, welcome to episode number 6 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, brought to you by CarbSmart, your smart choice for a low-carb lifestyle. I was hoping to interview Lori Casagnola, the president of the Nutrition and Metabolism Society, this week, but what with the sound problems we had with last week's interview, I wanted to make sure that we'd fix that problem first, so we're still working on that. We think we've got it, but we ran out of time. So this week, it's just me, and we're going to be talking about the new USDA dietary guidelines, which ain't all that new. I'm going to tell you about the surprising results of an experiment regarding estrogen and weight gain, and I'll be answering a couple of listener questions. So let's get right to it, okay? First, I'm going to start with a little segment I like to call Your Government in Action. The USDA dietary guidelines for 2010 have finally come out, now that it's 2011, and I'd like to say it's not a moment too soon, but we could have lived without them, and probably lived healthier and longer. It would have been worth the wait if they had actually made an about-face and ditched the god-awful advice they've been pushing for the past few decades, you know, the decades that have seen an explosion of obesity and diabetes and other health problems in the U.S. There are a couple of positive changes in the guidelines, but for the very most part, it's not just the same old fat-phobic, carb-pushing stuff. It's actually an intensification of the same. Now, to give credit, the USDA did recommend limiting added sugar. I certainly am not going to quarrel with that. They also have acknowledged that the biggest source of that sugar is sweetened drinks, soda, energy drinks, sports drinks, juices, and other forms of liquid candy. They've even had the guts to go against some pretty powerful lobbyists to recommend limiting sugar drinks. Recommending eliminating the sugar drinks entirely would have been better, but of course, this is a positive step. On the other hand, the USDA has also said that, quote, "Foods containing solid fats and added sugars are no more likely to contribute to weight gain than any other source of calories in an eating pattern that is within calorie limits." So they're still pushing the same old a calorie is a calorie is a calorie line, which, you know, is the equivalent of saying pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. They did recommend limiting trans fats. That's nice, but why not recommend eliminating trans fats? Well, man-made trans fats altogether. There are, by the way, some natural trans fats, such as CLA, which is found in grass-fed beef, that are actually positively good for you. But it's the man-made trans fats that are dangerous. They are still claiming that naturally saturated fats are bad for you, and the whole reason we wound up with all of those trans fats in the food supply is that we were told that the naturally saturated animal fats like butter and lard and tallow, and also the tropical saturated fats like coconut oil and palm oil were bad, 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 bad. So the food processors instead turned to artificially saturated fats instead. That's what hydrogenation is. It's taking an unsaturated fat and artificially saturating it. Polyunsaturated oils are not good for you to begin with, and artificially saturating them does not help matters one little bit. The USDA has suggested limiting refined grain products. That's nice. But nowhere have they acknowledged that whole grains are nearly as hard on blood sugar as refined grains, and sometimes even harder because they tend to be denser. Whole wheat bread generally has more grams of carbohydrate per slice than white bread simply because it doesn't puff up as far, so it doesn't have as much air in it. And they certainly have not admitted that all of that grain stuff is really just another source of sugar because starch is just a whole lot of sugar holding hands. They're still recommending limiting dietary cholesterol intake to, they say, prevent heart disease by keeping your cholesterol levels down. This is sort of like the thing I mentioned a few shows back about recommending you stay out of the night air to prevent malaria. It's just so outdated, it is downright quaint. We will ignore entirely the fact that the idea that high cholesterol levels are the cause of heart disease is questionable at best and perhaps entirely specious and an excuse to sell a lot of medication at worst. There is very little reason to think that eating cholesterol, that dietary cholesterol, significantly raises your blood cholesterol. At any time, roughly 2/3 of the cholesterol in your bloodstream was actually made in your liver. If you eat less cholesterol, your liver will make more. If you eat more cholesterol, your body will make less. Your liver can make all the cholesterol it wants because, you see, your body really needs cholesterol. If that balance gets messed up, it's not because you ate too much cholesterol. It's that something else, very likely your insulin levels, is throwing off the feedback mechanism and telling your liver to produce more cholesterol. Eating less cholesterol isn't going to do a damn thing to fix that. The USDA is also pushing some very, very serious sodium restriction. This, of course, is going to make food taste bad because the definition of salt is that which, when you leave it out of food, it makes it taste bad. But if sodium restriction recommendations actually get people to stop eating a whole bunch of processed food, which is by far the main source of sodium in the American diet, then maybe a little good will come of it because at the same time they'll also stop getting all the added sugar and starch and soy and other garbage that comes along with it. And maybe they'll start eating more fresh food. That would be great. But sodium restriction itself is actually questionable. The clinical studies show that it actually raises blood pressure in as many people as it lowers blood pressure. It's kind of a 50-50 thing. Some people doesn't affect blood pressure at all, but it's as likely to raise your blood pressure as it is to lower it if you restrict your salt. They're still pushing fat-free dairy. This is a damn shame. Not only is butterfat an excellent source of vitamin A, not that provitamin A you get from vegetables that your body has to convert into vitamin A, but actual real vitamin A. It also has a lot of healthy fats in it that stimulate the immune system and prevent cancer and good stuff like that. But all of that entirely aside, the calcium in your dairy products needs fat for your body to be able to absorb it. Women who have a fat-free yogurt for lunch because they think it's terribly healthy are actually doing their bones very little good. And I worry about that because women have been told to eat the fat-free dairy with the idea that they're getting lots of calcium that way, but they're not. They're taking it into their stomachs, but it's not necessarily going into their bones. Now, in response to an outcry from the low-carb community regarding the new recommendations, that outcry included a lot of scientists. The USDA still is denying that there's any evidence of benefit from carbohydrate restriction, and this is despite all sorts of peer-reviewed clinical studies demonstrating repeatedly that low-carb diets not only work great for weight loss, but they are actually more effective than a low-fat diet for improving your blood work, raising your HDL, lowering your LDL, lowering your blood pressure, and of course, lowering your triglycerides than low-fat or calorie-restricted diets. The USDA is also claiming low-carb diets are hard to adhere to. This is the thing they keep saying, oh, nobody can eat that way long-term. I have been eating this way for 15 years. I take issue with that. But what are they recommending instead, since they think low-carb diets are so hard to adhere to? Why, of course, they're recommending calorie restriction. Because, of course, going hungry for the rest of your life is so much easier than eating bacon and eggs for breakfast and steak for dinner. To give you an idea of how the USDA guidelines might play out in real life, I will refer you to a blog post by my friend Tom Naughton, whose documentary Fathead you really need to watch. It's hilarious and highly informative. You can get it through Amazon.com. I think you can also rent it from Netflix. You should also be reading Tom Naughton's blog, which I think is at fathead-movie.com. In his article about the USDA guidelines, Tom cited his daughter's USDA-approved school lunch, which consisted of chicken nuggets that were battered and deep-fried in highly processed nasty vegetable oil, macaroni and cheese, mandarin oranges in, you know, some kind of sweet sugary syrup, and the choice of a juice box, low-fat milk, or chocolate milk, with chocolate milk the most popular choice. And we're supposed to let these people decide how we're supposed to eat healthfully? I don't think so. Always remember that the USDA has nothing to do with health. They are not the Department of Health. They are the Department of Agriculture. They represent Monsanto and Cargill and Archer Daniels Midlands and all the other huge multinational grain and bean and other cheap commodity producing companies. And those companies have a very strong hand in determining the dietary guidelines. Those companies have exactly zero interest in your health. I don't know whether those corporations have any ties to Big Pharma. I do know that big money tends to mingle with big money. It wouldn't surprise me. The only USDA project that I'm truly happy about that I'm aware of is the Nutrient Database, which is a vastly useful resource. Other than that, I am going to continue to ignore them. So let's move along. In a few minutes, I'm going to explain the whole net or usable carbs concept for those of you who are new to the diet, and I may have a few tidbits that even those of you who have been low-carbing for a while don't know about. But first, I promise you some interesting information about estrogen and weight loss. So let me tell you about that. I have been reading, for the last few days, the book Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It by Gary Taubes. It's wonderful. It's based on Taubes' truly brilliant book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, which I also highly recommend. But Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It is actually written for a more mass market audience. It is for people who, to paraphrase the late, great Frank Zappa, had trouble approaching good calories, bad calories in its statistical density. I mean, I am a big-time health sciences geek, and it took me over a month to work my way through good calories, bad calories, reading it for, you know, maybe half an hour to an hour every morning. I enjoyed it very, very much. It's a wonderful book. I learned a great deal, but it was pretty dense. It took some serious plowing through. Why We Get Fat is actually very readable. I recommend it to all of you. You know, you can get it from your library or Amazon.com or your local bookstore. I also think we ought to all be giving copies of Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It to our doctors, because let's face it, they need it. Anyway, I haven't finished the book yet, so I don't have a full book review for you. I am enjoying it tremendously. But there was one particular experiment that Taubes cited in the part I've read so far that jumped out at me as something I needed to tell you about. He writes about an experiment that was done with female rats regarding the effect of estrogen on fat deposition. Now, the scientists doing the study took a bunch of female rats and surgically removed their ovaries, which effectively sent them abruptly into menopause. And any of you who have had a hysterectomy that also involved removing your ovaries know how this works. You immediately go into menopause. Well, going into menopause, those rats gained weight like crazy just from the loss of estrogen. We've all been told over and 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 over again that our weight is just a matter of calories in, calories out, and if we, you know, eat less, exercise more, blah, 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 blah. Now, going by that, you might think that there was something about the loss of estrogen that stimulated the rats to eat more or to exercise less or possibly both. I mean, maybe less estrogen made them depressed and so they ate a lot, or maybe less estrogen made them tired so they exercised less or something. Possibly both. You would, of course, be wrong. the scientist did this experiment again. He removed the ovaries from the female rats, but then he kept them in a rigidly controlled environment where their food supply was rigidly controlled. Even if they wanted to overeat, they simply could not. The food was not there. Well, they gained weight just like the first bunch. Indeed, their bodies robbed their other cells. It robbed their organs, their brains, their muscles to stash all the calories they could in the fat cells. It didn't matter how much they ate, they got fat anyway. Well, what does this tell us about menopause? And I say this as a woman of 52. So often, us middle-aged women are kind of looked down upon by the society at large. We're accused of letting ourselves go, and we're told if we'd just get a grip on ourselves and get over our midlife crisis and, you know, get over the empty nest syndrome and get out there and get some exercise and stop eating so much and whatever, we could, you know, if we just do all that stuff, we could get our girlish figures back. Well, first of all, yeah, I never had a particularly girlish figure to start with. Even when I was a girl, not all that girlish. I kind of went from being a little girl to being matronly by the time I was 14. But that entirely aside, it turns out that this hormonal deck is heavily stacked against us. Many of you have probably suspected this all along. And, you know, yet the authorities keep telling you, oh no, it's just calories in, calories out. Well, that's bull. It's not true. It turns out that estrogen is, for women, a major signal for shunting calories away from the fat cells to be burned as energy, whereas the loss of estrogen signals the body instead to store those calories as fat. Now, of course, estrogen is not the only hormone that signals the body to store or burn fat. The most powerful of these hormones is insulin. And we can control insulin through our diet, and that's why we eat low carb. But I don't know of an estrogen-controlling diet. That's nothing that I've heard of, being able to control your estrogen through diet. So my message to all of you who are, like me, middle-aged, is, you know, stop blaming yourselves quite so much, okay? Do what you can do and lose the weight you can lose and stop feeling like you're doing something terribly wrong just because you can't get back into the jeans you wore when you were 18. You know, you can't get back to your high school weight. Do what you can do, control your insulin levels, cut the carbs, and then cut yourself at least a little slack because biology is stacked against you here. And take heart in the fact that many women start to lose weight again a while after menopause. That's why there's so many skinny old ladies. In the meanwhile, I have an appointment as I record this show. I have an appointment tomorrow with a doctor in my town, Bloomington, Indiana, who specializes in bioidentical hormones for anti-aging. Now, interestingly, his practice also focuses on weight loss. So it'll be very interesting to talk to this guy. Now, I got interested because I was interested in the anti-aging thing, partly because of osteoporosis, partly because of some other issues. I've been using bioidentical progesterone for about 18 months, but my regular internist is not well-versed in the use of bioidentical hormone therapy and was reluctant to work with any of the other hormones to do a full panel. So I started looking for a specialist, and now I have this appointment tomorrow. I will let you know how it goes. I will let you know what the results are. I'm particularly interested because his website also talks about hypothyroidism and insomnia, two issues I have been dealing with for quite a while. So I will let you know if I get on hormones and then suddenly start losing weight. Okay, let's move on. It's time for Low Carb Voices. Since we didn't have an interview this week, I thought I'd answer a couple of questions. And the first is from a new low-carber named Carol Jameson. Carol, thanks for calling in. And she wanted to know about usable or net carbs. Here's the call.
Hi, Dana. This is Carol Jameson from Detroit, and I love your show. I'm a new low-carb lifestyler and had a question about usable carbs. I've heard you in one of your shows, you talked about subtracting the fiber from the carbohydrate count. And I was wondering if you could go into more detail about that. Right now, I'm sort of counting the carbs, and I didn't start off by subtracting the fiber. So if you could give me some insight on the usable carbs and what that whole thing is about, that would be great. Again, I'm loving your show. Keep up the good work. Take care. Bye-bye.
First of all, thanks for listening, Carol. I am so glad you like the show. And welcome to the wonderful world of low carbing. We have a whole lot more fun here than most people suspect. The net carbs or usable carbs concept was originated by doctors Michael and Mary Dan Eads in their wonderful, wonderful book, Protein Power, highly recommended. And the reasoning behind this is very simple. Fiber is a kind of carbohydrate, or actually it's a series of kinds of carbohydrate. But it's a form of carbohydrate that human beings cannot digest nor absorb. Indeed, that's kind of one of the definitions of fiber, is carbohydrate you can't digest or absorb. That's why we can't live on grass the way the cows do. Fiber is just passed pretty much, you know, unchanged, and that's why you can use it as a laxative, because it just goes through you. The Eads has realized that since we don't absorb fiber, it doesn't raise our blood sugar, and therefore it doesn't cause an insulin release. And better yet, fiber also displaces some of the carbohydrate we could digest. So they started telling their patients at their weight loss clinic, back then they had a clinic in Little Rock, Arkansas, to subtract the fiber grams from the total carbohydrate grams and only count the grams of carbohydrate that were actually going to raise their blood sugar and cause an insulin release. Now, the great thing about this is it gives us a lot more variety in our diets. Since, in general, the best sources of fiber are vegetables, this means we can eat some more onions and mushrooms on our steak, we can have more avocado on our omelets, we can have a much greater variety of vegetables in our salad in bigger portions, we can put more vegetables in a casserole or a skillet supper, and this gives us a lot more interesting recipes. It also means we can eat a little bit more fruit than we would if we were actually counting the fiber grams with the rest of the carbs. For instance, a half a cup of fresh raspberries has 7 grams of carbohydrate, but 4 of those grams are fiber. So we only have to count 3 grams. That's not a lot of carb. So if you're feeling kind of self-indulgent and haven't been eating a lot of other carbs that day, you could probably get away with a whole cup of raspberries, or maybe have a few strawberries too. What the heck? Now, if you need to figure out the net or usable carb count for foods that don't come with a label, and we sincerely hope that most of the foods you eat don't come with a label, you can, of course, buy a food count book. I have one out. Dana Carpenter's Carbohydrate and Calorie Counter. Anyway, I'll have a link to it put up on the show page, danislowcarbforlife.com. And my food count book does include carb and fiber grams both, and it has a column specifically with that math done for you. It's got a usable or net carbs column that's highlighted, so it's very, very easy to glance and see what the usable carbs are for any particular food item. We've even bolded all of the foods that get have 5 grams or fewer net carbs per serving. You can also go to the USDA nutrient database. I mentioned that earlier. I'll give you the URL, but it's a big, ugly URL. So instead of reciting it here, I'm going to ask my producer, Kevin. Hi, Kevin. To put up a link to the USDA nutrient database on the show page. Again, danislowcarbforlife.com. The USDA nutrient database is a fantastic resource. It will not only tell you carbs and fiber and calories and protein, it will tell you, you know, how much monounsaturated versus polyunsaturated fat. It will tell you how much of each amino acid. It will tell you all the vitamins, all the minerals, all that stuff. It's fantastic. You need to use it. Or if you have a smartphone, I would be willing to bet that you could get a food discount app for your phone. I don't have a smartphone, so I'm not up to date with all the apps. But with all of them out there, there's got to be one that lets you look up your food. I can't believe there's not. Now, if you're buying a food that does have a nutrition label, it will, at least in the U.S., have the total carb count listed, and underneath that, it will have also separate listings for the grams of sugar and the grams of fiber. Now, those two numbers are included in that total carb count. Keep in mind that the sugar and fiber numbers will probably not add up to that total carb number because they don't require nutrition labels to have a separate listing for grams of starch. Any carb that isn't sugar or fiber will be starch and won't be separately listed. You can subtract the fiber number from the total carbohydrate number to get the net or usable carbs. That's the grams of carb you actually need to count. Also, keep in mind that the government allows food labels to put 0 grams of carb per serving if it has less than a half a gram per serving. So it could be as much as, you know, 0.48 grams of carb per serving, which, if you're eating a fair amount of a food, could add up. For instance, Splenda is not actually, the granular Splenda is not actually carb-free. It has, if I recall correctly, about 0.4 grams of carbohydrate per teaspoon, but I'd have to look that up. Don't quote me on it. But the point being that if you use a whole cup of Splenda, you're going to get some carbs. If you are not in the United States, you need to listen up now. Some countries do not include the fiber number in that total carbohydrate number. They have already subtracted it out. And if your country is one of those, then subtracting the fiber number again is going to give you an inaccurately low net carb count. You're going to get a lot more carbs than you thought you were, and you're going to wonder why you're not losing weight and why your blood sugar's wonky. So you need to know the food labeling laws for your country. And by the way, Americans, if you're buying imported food and the carb count, the net carb count looks too good to be true, this could be what's going on. I've known this to be a problem with imported food. One more thing. During the low-carb boom of 2003 to 2004, when the processed food manufacturers were churning out all sorts of new products to cash in, they kind of expanded that net carbs concept quite a lot. Some decided that any carb that had a low glycemic index, they didn't have to count and they could subtract it from the total. And others decided that what's called resistant starch could be discounted. And many, and maybe most, decided they didn't have to count the carbs in maltitol and the other sugar alcohols. And all of this made for some very questionable food labeling. You want to keep in mind the old, if it sounds too good to be true rule. By the way, I did not include maltitol in the carb counts for some of the recipes, particularly in my earlier cookbooks, because I very simply didn't know how to count it. I knew that you absorb some maltitol, but not all maltitol. And, you know, how did I know how much you were absorbing? Well, I finally found a fairly credible figure asserting that roughly half of maltitol is absorbed. So now, if I'm reading the label on some sugar-free candy or something like that, I will count half the maltitol grams as part of the net carb count. Again, just be wary of any too-good-to-be-true labeling, okay? If you really want to know how food affects your blood sugar, there is no substitute for a glucometer, a blood sugar meter. That, of course, involves sticking some holes in your pinkies, but it will give you a clear answer, and there are a few things that are better than a clear answer. Our second question on Listener Voices today actually comes from a friend of mine from my Toastmasters Club here in Bloomington, Indiana. Her name's Regina, and Regina is not only a low-carber, she has some other sensitivities, and she can't have gluten, and she can't have dairy, and it's a pretty complex situation. She and I have talked about it more than once. Well, here's Regina's question.
Hi, Dana. I'm calling to answer one of your questions about what is difficult to about low carb. Excuse me. This is Regina. And I had a hard time deciding between dealing with family or travel, and I finally decided on travel. Even though I'll pack lots of jerky and lots of nuts in my pockets and in my briefcase, I go on these 5 to 6 day audits where we're stuck in a conference room with a group of people and they don't let us out. They'll often bring in lunch. Now, if they give us a menu to pick from, that's usually okay. I can choose something pretty easily. But if they bring in lunch, they'll often bring in pizza or sandwiches or pasta salads. And sandwiches are bad because I can't eat any gluten at all, so I can't just peel the bread off. And one of the other irritating things is one of my main clients has this quote-unquote healthy initiative program going on, so all their food has to be less than like 20 or 30% fat that they bring in for lunch. So that's where my tough time comes in. I can only eat so much jerky and nuts. Sometimes I'll get a little skimpy salad, and I'm pretty hungry by the time dinner comes around. So if anyone has any suggestions on other ways to deal with this kind of situation, I would be grateful. Fortunately, it only happens once a month or once every other month. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Regina, like I said, you and I have talked about your restrictions some, and I've been thinking about this question ever since you called in, and thanks for calling in, by the way. I really can only think of two possible solutions to this problem. One is to get a small cooler or insulated food bag. You can get them about the size of a six-pack and just carry your food along, you know, carry along cold chicken or something like that. I'm assuming that if your cooler isn't any bigger than, let's say, someone else's briefcase, you're going to be able to find a place to stash it. And, yeah, it'll look different from a briefcase, but what the heck. There are also thermal containers that come with a built-in ice pack in the lid. You take the lid off, you stash it in the freezer overnight, then come morning, you fill the container with, you know, your chicken salad or whatever you want to fill it with, put on that frozen lid, and your food will stay safely refrigerated until lunch. You can, of course, get a regular thermos and take along a thermos of homemade soup or a beanless chili or whatever. So packing your lunch along, I suppose, is a possibility. The other possibility, especially, of course, if you're out of town overnight, you know, you're not going to be able to do this in a motel. So the other possibility is a few days before you're going, if you know where you're going to be going, look up local restaurants online. You want to look up local restaurants that deliver. And most restaurants now have their menus available online. So look at the menus. Look at the delivery and look for restaurants that have food that you can eat. In particular, it struck me that if you could find a Greek place, Greek roasted chicken and a salad, it would be just about ideal. You know, get a bunch of extra olives, whatever. And then a suitable interval before lunch, slip out to the ladies' room, use your cell phone to call the restaurant that has the food you want and order it for delivery. You could, like I say, get that Greek roasted chicken. You could get from a Mexican place, you could maybe get fajitas without any tortillas, but with an extra order of guacamole. Whatever other low-carb, gluten-free, dairy-free food you can find at local restaurants. Now, you probably don't want the delivery person coming to the conference room, you know, for you personally. So if you can, if there's a receptionist, you might tell the receptionist you're doing this and slip her the money to pay for your food. And then you can just wander out to the reception desk while other people are eating pizza and pick up your food. It wouldn't hurt to tip her a buck or two for the trouble. As always, you're going to need to have a thick skin about obviously eating differently than other people, but you've been doing that for a while now, as have I, so I don't think that's going to be a big problem for you. If people ask, you can brush it off with a quick, it's a medical thing, or I have an allergy, or I have a sensitivity, something like that, without any further explanation. On the other hand, I know you, Regina, and I know you love talking nutrition, so you could go further than that if you wanted. Either way, you know, feel free to explain it more fully if you want. If you don't want to explain it more fully, just take care of yourself and let people wonder. What people don't know won't kill them. That's the best I can do, and I hope it helps. Okay, that's it for this